Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our weekend review. On this episode, we're looking back on a weekend where Man City were blessed with the press that transgressed Tuchel's success. Arteta felt better as his go-getter Gunners put the stunner on Spurs, while Kane looked drained as he tried in vain to persuade us all he can still be bothered to play at White Hart Lane. And Jose Mourinho was left in Roman ruins as Immobile saved the day and Sarri's side made some headway. Ooh, some strained rhymes today. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today is a man who has a brand new iPhone, and I'm very jealous of it. Graham Ruthven, hello.
Hello, Ryan. That was very impressive. I think you've been inspired by our Commentary 101 episode. Maybe some Peter Drury there. I feel like you have drawn upon, particularly with the Mourinho reference there. Bravo, sir.
Yes, I've inadvertently quoted Peter Drury and the Roman ruins. You're quite right there, Graham. You're quite right. But that is very much what Jose was left in with a defeat in the Rome Derby, which we shall talk about later on today. I would like to talk about your iPhone, though, Graham. You've got one of the fancy new big ones, so I should say. And is the battery still going? Because I think you said it's been going for about 7 days now.
Yeah, I think it might be nuclear, this thing. I mean, I don't know how much battery talk. I don't know how entertaining this is, but yes, I've charged it once since I got it on Friday morning, and looking at it now, it has 68%. So that is quite remarkable.
That's very, very impressive. Do you know what, Graham? I'm in Italy at the moment. It would actually be cheaper for me to fly back to the US to buy a new iPhone than to buy one locally. Isn't that fun?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't care about like your carbon footprint, I'd say that's a fantastic strategy, yeah.
Very good point. I did get an electric car today, Graham, so I'm feeling a bit better about my carbon footprint.
Yeah, you're offsetting it that way. And also, I think the boxes on the iPhones are smaller now so that they say it's for the environment, but it's so they don't have to pay for a charger in that box. We all know that's the real reason. So yeah, I guess you could offset it by flying back to the States and doing all those things.
That's right. I'm saving polar bears left, right and centre, Graham. Also here with us is a man who hasn't bought a $1,000 phone, but who is dialed in, delivering more stats than a weekend of foot mob notifications on your phone, Joe Lowry.
Oh, Ryan, that was brilliant. And I echo Graham's sentiment. The introduction was fantastic as well. Listeners, right before we started recording, Ryan said, okay, I've got a really wordy introduction and I'm nervous for it. And Ryan, you pulled it off beautifully.
Thanks for telling him how the sausage is made, Joe.
You're welcome. Yeah. You're welcome.
thank you very much. I do appreciate that, Joe. How are you doing on this fine day, Joseph?
I am quite well. I'm just still shocked that Graham like complimented you and started off on a positive note as well. I'm kind of reeling from that. This is going to be a good show, fellas. This is going to be a good show.
I think Graham's in a good mood because he's been watching Grand Prix this weekend. Lewis Hamilton, easy for me to say, in the Russian GP's 100th win, Graham. Did that do it for you?
I mean, it was incredible drama. Lando Norris is my boy, so for him to lose out like he did, going for his first F1 victory, he holds off Lewis Hamilton for much of the race. Lewis Hamilton is eating away at his advantage by a tenth of a second here and there, and just as it looks like Lando's going to do it, he's going to hold off the 7-time world champion, rain, with 2 laps to go, and it's a lot of rain, and faced with a call of whether to pit for the final 2 laps, Lando makes the call to brave it out. Hamilton pits and it pours for the final 2 laps. Lando just can't keep it on the track and he finishes 7th, having led for the majority of the race. So I very much enjoyed it as a spectacle, but it was a bit draining that Lando didn't win it. I was a bit upset about that. And so was he, it seems, because it appeared he'd been crying after the race. So that's not so good.
Oh, no, poor crying Lando. In the rain? That's no good. Lando is an unusual name for sports people, Graham. It's like Landon without the N. That's what I've just observed.
Yeah, good observation there. I like it. Lando. It's a cool name.
Well, that's Landon without the N. TSS is without the Taylor today. Taylor Rockwell is on vacation this week. The very same week that Man United happened to lose to Aston Villa at
Suspicious.
Old Trafford. Coincidence? I think not. I think not. Bruno Fernandes took and attempted to take a late penalty, Joe, and I think it just landed in my backyard a couple of minutes ago. The first time he's ever missed the target in 15 career penalties. So before we get going today, I want to know from both of you, what's your penalty technique? Are you like a careful placement kind of guy, or were you Panenka now and then, or just hit it really hard and hope for the best? That's my approach, Graham. How about you?
Yeah, the latter. I was always actually pretty good at penalties because my only focus was I'm going to leather this as hard as I can, and I'm going to lean over the ball to make sure I don't do like what Bruno Fernandes did at the weekend. And when you like, I stopped playing soccer after like the age of 14. So when you do that, 14-year-old goalkeepers like can't really do anything about it. So I was pretty good at penalties. I was the who's really good at penalties in professional soccer? Ivan Tony. I've heard he's really good at penalties. I was the Ivan Tony of my day, 14-year-old pickup soccer.
The Ivan Tony of my day. We should get a plaque made of that for you. How about you, Joe? I imagine you've got like a little stash of notes in your sock, like a well-prepared goalkeeper, and you're looking at where you should put it.
Yeah, I've just turned the table. I'm doing the kicker version of Jordan Pickford. No, I'm much more placement over power because I am bad at soccer, and I feel like that is my best chance to actually get the ball in the back of the net. I typically go to a bottom corner, either side, and beyond that, I can't spill any more beans in case I ever have to score a penalty on either one of you.
That's true. Yeah, you shouldn't give away the game. And on that note, we should talk about a team who also didn't find the net, Joe. Chelsea, the champions of Europe, did not find the net against Manchester City, the champions of England. 1-0 to City, their game finishing. A statement win on Saturday from City. Pep Guardiola has now overseen more victories than any other manager in Man City's history. Bully for him. This one, Joe, felt like quite a one-sided game for a big game. We had two very drilled systems. It had the potential to be a little bit, you know, immovable object versus unstoppable force, blah, blah, blah. But it did feel kind of like City were on top of this one, Joe.
Yeah, the first line in my notes for this game is City dominated. And I think they did, right? They come out and they play exactly how you expect a Pep Guardiola team to play. Their shape was shifting into different things when they had possession. Defensively, they pressed really, really well in this 4-4-2, 4-2-3-1 that also shifted a little bit, but with De Bruyne up top alongside a number 9 in Phil Foden. And it was some interesting personnel in different spots, but we've really come to expect to see that from Pep at this point in his managerial career. So City executed a lot of their things really well. But kind of where I wanted to start this off, despite City being the team that came out with these 3 points, is Thomas Tuchel's system change, or maybe shape change is a better way to put it, because a lot of the same principles were there, but he shifted his formation in this game. And a lot of times formation chat, I think, is overblown, and it might be a little bit in this game too from what I've seen on Twitter, but they did change into this 5-3-2, 3-5-2 shape and went away from that 3-4-3 shape that Tuchel's used primarily in his Chelsea career so far. There's not a ton of differences between them, and we've seen Tuchel go back and forth at times, even as recently as the Tottenham game last weekend. They started in the 3-4-3, ended in the 3-5-2, and it worked really well for them in that Tottenham game. So maybe Tuchel thinks, okay, we're going to come into this one, and I'm going to use that same shape, continue the trend from last week, and we're going to get another result here. That's really not how it played out. They ended up with Jorginho as the 6, and then Kante and Kovacic as the 8s, and Werner and Lukaku in front of them. And I don't know if this was the default game plan or if it was a result of the shape, but essentially Chelsea just ended up defending in this mid to low 5-3-2 block for really long stretches of this game. And they are a good defensive team and they made life difficult for City. But man, I thought they were behind the ball way too much in this game, and that made it really challenging for them to actually create consistent attacking chances. And to be honest, it didn't really create those chances until later on in the game once it had opened up a bit and they were really pushing for that equalizer.
It was City's off the ball game that I personally found most impressive. Because as you say, Joe, a lot of what we saw from City on the ball is what we tend to see from them. You know, players in maybe slightly unorthodox positions, doing slightly unorthodox things, but all very well. But from the start, the high press from City was really, really clear. And I thought it explained why Guardiola picked the front line that he did. Obviously, recently we've seen Ferran Torres play as kind of the number 9. We've had Mahrez in on the right side, but he went with Grealish, Foden, Jesus. All three of those players are very good at closing down opponents quickly, and it just denied Chelsea the chance to play their way through when they did have the ball, when they would have looked to attack. And Foden was the one charged with leading that high press. He did it really, really well in this game plan. De Bruyne was there to get on top of Jorginho and stop him doing what Jorginho tends to do in these games. And I think we're also starting to see, or finally seeing, the importance of Jesus to this City team. He's never going to be that number nine that everyone thought he was going to be when Aguero left the club. But his work rate in a kind of slightly wider role as he's been playing this season is incredible. And he's fast becoming one of Pep Guardiola's favourites this season. It's almost as if, to compare him to a previous Pep Guardiola player, Pedro, who I think we might be talking about later in this podcast, he maybe comes to mind, you know, how he kind of stretches the pitch in a wide area, but also his work rate is really important on the defensive side of the ball. So that was the thing that really caught my eye. And the result of this was Lukaku's left completely isolated, and then Tuchel's response is to take off Kante and introduce Havertz, who you would believe might do a better job of getting closer to Lukaku and offering that support. But the problem here was this, that it just robbed Chelsea of another player in the centre of the pitch to match up against City. And it left both Lukaku and Havertz isolated up top. So that didn't really do anything to change the game. And at times it was as if City were playing with a central unit of six players, I guess. Maybe Jesus is an outlet, so maybe five players. But Foden, Grealish, joining De Bruyne, Rodri and Bernardo, and making that area of the pitch off the ball as compact and congested as possible. And I just thought, this to me is a game plan that might work for City in the Champions League. I think that this sort of game plan is the thing that might see them take the final step in Europe. You know, in Europe they've maybe been guilty of trying to impose their own game a little bit too much on opponents, that maybe on the defensive side of the ball is where those incremental gains can be made.
Joe, to come back to your observations about Chelsea's shape and the fact that they were maybe a bit negative sitting back quite a lot in this game, do you have any thoughts on why that was happening? Was it simply that the Man City press was just dominating, it was crushing them, which, you know, it was a very impressive press that they were playing? Or is it, you know, the lack of Mason Mount in the system? Is it that Tuchel just made the wrong decision here? What caused them to be pinned back like this and to lack width despite having five across the middle?
I think it is a lot of those different factors that you're just mentioning, Ryan. I don't know that it's any one specific thing. I do want to give, again, credit to how City approached this game, because it's very easy for me to just fall into, Tuchel got this wrong, this didn't make sense. But City did make life extremely challenging for Chelsea. And so that's reason number one. Reason number two, though, is I think Tuchel thought that there's a lot of thinks and thoughts in there. So this is me just trying to reason this out. I think Tuchel approached this game as, if we can make life hard for City, that's going to make life easier for us, right? The more numbers that City push forward, the more space there's going to be for us to counterattack into. And let's not forget, Romelu Lukaku and Timo Werner, that is, on paper, a fearsome counterattacking forward line, right? And you have Kovacic, who's great at progressing the ball on the dribble. You've got Kante, who's pretty good at that as well, as the two eights, and then width from the fullbacks, and Reece James to start, and then Azpilicueta after Reece James comes off injured. And then you've got Marcus Alonso on the left. The pieces kind of make sense, and I can see them forming this counterattacking puzzle in my mind. The thing is, it just didn't work, right? For the number of reasons that I've mentioned, that Graham's mentioned, that you mentioned, Ryan, it didn't work. And so it makes Thomas Tuchel look really bad in this game, because the tactics he rolled out didn't work and the adjustments that he tried to put out there didn't really change the game either. But to be honest, I think there's a lot of validity in what he tried to do. Crowding midfield, trying to create turnovers with those three central midfielders, and then counterattacking quickly and connecting with the front line. A lot of those things make sense to me. It just didn't play out in a way that worked for Chelsea.
Yeah, it certainly didn't. And Graham, to go to what City were doing here, this is kind of what I hoped the Champions League final would be, you know, in terms of what City put on the table. Is it too simple to say, Graham, that this shows what happens when Pep doesn't tinker too much and doesn't overthink a game, when he, you know, plays a defensive midfielder and has the right system in place to face the right position? Because he completely outclassed Chelsea here, quite the opposite of what happened in the Champions League final. Is it as simple to say as this is when Guardiola does what he's supposed to do?
Yeah, I think that might be overly simplistic, because I think if this doesn't work, people are talking about why Phil Foden is playing as the number nine and not, you know, Ferran. I know City don't have a world-class number nine, but they have Jesus, who can play through there. Ferran Torres has scored a lot of goals as a centre-forward. So I think if it doesn't work, maybe the narrative is this is Guardiola overthinking it again. You know, he played Sterling in the Champions League final, which that was painted as overthinking it, despite the fact that Sterling was playing in his, like, natural position. It was just that he was out of form, and it was a bit of a surprise to see him in there. So I just think, Yeah, I think a lot of the differences on the defensive side of the ball, repeating myself a little bit there, but I also think the Premier League needed this result. I just had a sense that Chelsea might start to, if they'd won this game, they might start to stretch their legs and make a little bit of a mockery of how we all predicted this would be the tightest title race for years. I just, even after this game, I still have this sense that they are the best team in the Premier League, and there is that possibility that they could win it quite comfortably. But now, there's just 1 point between the top five, and I think Brighton, if they win tonight, they can go top of the table, and there's 2 points between the top six. So it really has tightened up that top end of the Premier League. So as a neutral, I didn't have a horse in this race. I'm not a Chelsea or a City fan. I was quite pleased to see City win, just because, as I say, it tightens everything up at the top of the table.
It does indeed, and it makes you realise, you know, City go from not beating Southampton at home to this. How much things can change in 7 days as well. It's quite stunning in this league, really, and it shows you that the relative parity between the big six, if you will. Joe, I think one thing I noticed from this game was the strength on City's left flank. So you had Grealish over there, you had De Bruyne sort of operating vaguely on the left, and Cancelo, who had a really good game. He seemed to find loads of space. Maybe Reece James coming off didn't help things, but Chelsea, as I mentioned, lack width, and it seemed that City were really exploiting that left flank. And I suppose once again I'll reiterate that I'm really pleased in how Jack Grealish is being used. I thought he wouldn't be a 90 minutes every single game kind of guy. Well, he wasn't here, but you know what I mean. Relied upon, and
sure,
he's fitting into the system so well, and this left flank looks so good with him there.
I'm all aboard the Grealish Express right now, Ryan. I think you're sitting up in the front, and maybe I'm a little bit behind you on this train. But man, it's fun to watch Jack Grealish play soccer, and I think it's especially fun to watch him play in this Pep team, where he can do all the things he's so good at within a detailed possession structure that actually makes City really fun to watch. It doesn't make them boring in most cases. It makes them electric in possession, which is not something that can be said for a lot of teams in the world right now. And so when Grealish gets on the ball, a lot of the time he's going to get it on his right foot and he's going to drive at this 45-degree diagonal angle inside, beat a defender or lay the ball off to Cancelo on the overlap or lay the ball off to De Bruyne inside and then continue his run, get it back and do something magical. And we're seeing that over and over again right now with City. And when you have those quality players around him, the players I just mentioned, Cancelo and De Bruyne and Phil Foden in the middle and players coming up from behind, Silva and Rodri, they have so many passing options in those moments that they really are a hard team to stop. I mentioned it earlier, Chelsea are a good defensive team. And the goal in this game from City doesn't come from any intricate possession play or doesn't really come from a magical moment from Jack Grealish. It comes in the 53rd minute after a corner kick to Cancelo. Cancelo shoots his shot, doesn't make it through all the traffic in the box. And then Gabriel Jesus gets on the ball and scores a striker's goal. It's a beautiful goal. Doesn't come from any, you know, magical moment or anything like that. But City are capable of those moments. And I like the moves they had in possession to switch the ball from side to side, get it to the weak side of Chelsea's midfield three, get it, you know, across either behind Kovacic or behind Conte, and then get it into Grealish or get it into Jesus or De Bruyne on the weak side in those pockets. I think on an individual level and a team-wide level, City are doing so many things in possession, or at least they did in this game. They're doing so many things in possession that make it really hard for opposing teams to defend against them.
So let me ask you this then, Joe. Right now, who is the better team out of these two teams, Man City and Chelsea? I know it's not an easy question, and I know it probably turns up, it depends who turns up on any given day, but if you had to pick someone now, would it be City?
I think I'm still with Graham, to be honest here. This is a really hard one to answer, but if Chelsea are in that 3-4-3 shape and they do have, you know, one of the last things I'll say in this game, and then I'll actually answer the question, Ryan, is in the 3-4-3 shape for Chelsea, you only have really two de facto central midfielders. Usually it's Conte and Jorginho, but sometimes it's Kovacic and Jorginho. You usually only have those two central midfielders, but then you have Mason Mount and Kai Havertz, whoever the two narrow wingers are. You have those players dropping in to almost create a box in midfield in possession. So there's a way to look at this Chelsea team that rolled out against City and say they actually played at a disadvantage in central midfield. They purposely handicapped themselves. And I don't think this is Tuchel's line of thought at all. But there is a way to think about this game where you say Chelsea had one fewer central midfielders than normal, at least at times in possession. So I think if Chelsea are in that 3-4-3 shape and they try to go for it a little more, part of me still says that they are the better team. And maybe that doesn't make sense. Maybe I'm just buying into what we've seen in spurts so far this season. But I'm with Graham. I think Chelsea are still the team to beat this season. And maybe that doesn't make sense, but that's where I'm at right now.
One final question from me, Graham, before on this game. Did you enjoy watching it? I mean, there are lots of really good Premier League games this weekend. We're going to talk about a couple of them coming up shortly. But as dominant as City were and as intriguing as this tactical battle was and these systems were to watch unfold, was it edge of the seat stuff for you?
Not really. Towards the end of the first half, I think I tweeted something to the effect of, when I was watching it, I'm thinking, wow, this is so good. This is two really, really well coached teams. This is excellent soccer. And I'm a bit bored, which was, I think the second half was slightly livelier, certainly in terms of goal scoring opportunities. But yeah, it was in terms of a spectacle, I'm more of a sort of vibes FC sort of guy. give me a flawed Manchester United performance, which results in 7 goals every day over this, even though I can appreciate the tactical and the coaching brilliance of this, a game like this, but from an entertainment point of view, it maybe wasn't edge of the seat stuff.
So was this an F1 race with no rain and no overtaking and everyone being very competent, Graham?
Yeah, and the two best teams at the head of the pack. Yeah, pretty much. Or the two best drivers, sorry, I should say.
Two best drivers, indeed. Well, these two drivers have got some big Champions League games coming up this week. Chelsea heading to Juventus. Man City facing little old PSG. So we've got some good Champions League action coming up for both these teams this coming week. And we'll be here later in the week to review it, of course. After this break, North London Derby time.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking Premier League, specifically the North London Derby. Arsenal 3, Tottenham 1. Spurs have now lost 3 London Derbies in a row, to Palace, to Chelsea, now to Arsenal. This one probably hurts a little bit more for them. Graham, Arsenal looking pretty good in this one, and Thierry Henry also looking pretty good in his 90s JVC shirt in the crowd too.
Yeah, he has been on classic football shirts, for sure. I don't have that one on my OnlyFans, I have to say, but I approve a lot. It was a very strong look from Thierry Henry. Even the hat as well kind of completed the look. It was good and interesting. Did anyone catch who he was sitting next to?
I didn't.
Go on.
He was sitting next to Daniel Ek, the Spotify owner, who of course very publicly tried to buy Arsenal a few months ago. So that's interesting. I do wonder how much Arsenal rolled out the red carpet for him when he turned up with the guy who wants to buy the club from the Cronkies.
Interesting. He wasn't wearing a vintage shirt, so I didn't really notice him, Graham. I've got to be honest. Arsenal, Graham, are they good now? It seems like they were, you know, pretty quick on the ball. They were looked nice and aggressive. They were very positive and a really nice passing game. Was it the second goal where it was one of those classic Arsenal end-to-end goals? What's going on? Yeah. Are they good now? Am I supposed to think they're good now, Graham?
Oh, I don't know, Ryan. I just don't know. I mean, we were pretty hard on Arsenal not so long ago, just a few weeks ago, like last month. But I feel like that was vindicated, like that was justifiable at the time. And now they've been pretty good. You know, it's not just this game. They weren't so good to get home to Norwich, but then they get a tough win away to Burnley, which I thought showed a lot of progress there. And then this was a very impressive performance. So yeah, now they're deserving of praise. And I guess that shows things can change very quickly. And I saw an Arsenal blogger describe this match. I think it was LeGrove, if anyone follows him on Twitter. He described this match as a referendum on Mikel Arteta. And I think Arteta himself actually felt that. You could see it in the way that he was celebrating on the touchline very emphatically, the way the team celebrated afterwards. And in a sense, you could say it was slightly over the top. The pictures that were posted from the dressing room, it was as if Arsenal had kind of won a trophy rather than just three games in a row for the first time this season. However, I do think that this all illustrates how important this match was for them. Of course, it could all come crashing down very quickly. Arsenal could fall just as quickly as they have risen over the last few weeks, but it feels like Arteta is finally producing some results with the players that he wants on the pitch. You know, that's an important thing to mention, as injuries have cleared up, the transfer market is closed, they got some business done. And in terms of that first team on the pitch, it's looking pretty good. There's some balance there. There's some relationships there. So yeah, I liked what I saw from Arsenal in this game.
And some youngsters doing very well, Graham, as well. Emil Smith-Rowe, who was very good against AFC Wimbledon in the League Cup game, which led up to this one as well. I was getting Thomas Müller vibes from him, the Raumdeuter. He seemed to be really exploiting and finding space very well. Is that fair to say?
I can see what you're saying there. He kind of drifts all over the place. He starts out on the left side in terms of his paper position, as I would call it, but he doesn't really stick to that position. And often it's Kieran Tierney who provides the width on that side. So yes, the awareness of space, I can see Müller qualities there. I think he's maybe slightly technically better on the ball than Thomas Müller. I don't get the, as Barney Roney described Müller, I don't get the vibes of a junior doctor on a fun run from Emil Smith Rowe. But yes, I like, again, kind of repeat myself a little bit, I like what I see from him, and I also like the relationship he's forging with Martin Odegaard. And I think we're seeing why Arteta was so keen to get Odegaard back to the club. Not so long ago, about a year ago, 12 months ago, Arsenal were really struggling for creativity, and between Smith Rowe and Odegaard, they have that creative platform high up the pitch, with Thomas Partey and Xhaka kind of providing the platform in behind them. So yeah, there's a balance to Arsenal. When they get, I do have doubts about their depth options when they need to rotate or when there's injuries or suspensions, but when they get their first team on the pitch, as they did against Spurs, there's a good team there.
Graham, I love you talking about the platform there for Arsenal, because I thought in this game they had so much fluidity that it almost made it hard for me to figure out what was going on at times. But they had some set pieces happening. Not free kicks, not corner kicks. That's poor word choice for me. But they had some things that were set in how they approached the game in possession. They had at least three defenders back, sometimes four, depending on the positioning of the outside backs. But they had the back line, and then they had a double pivot of Granit Xhaka and Thomas Partey in front of the back line. And then that gave Emil Smith-Rowe and Martin Odegaard freedom to move and to shift, exactly like you're saying. And when Arsenal have those two guys moving and rotating and finding space in the attack, they're incredibly fun to watch. And I don't know, to kind of hit at, you know, Ryan's question, are they good? I don't know if Arsenal's a good team right now. I'm still leaning towards probably not, at least not really contending for Champions League spots. But they can put together some wonderful sequences in possession. And they did that in this game, and I think a lot of the credit for that should go to Emil Smith-Rowe and Martin Odegaard.
All right then, Tottenham fans, you've braced yourself long enough. We're going to get to talking about your team now. Joe, what did you make of Tottenham in this game? It seemed like there's quite a lot going on here. They were constantly exposed at defence here. They in the first half, they were maybe trying to press, but they didn't really have the midfield to back it up when it went wrong. And they sort of dropped back in the second half and were certainly sturdier in the second half. But it all gone wrong by that point. The 4-3-3, Joe, with Dele Alli and Ndombele in it, didn't seem like it was optimal for covering ground. It wasn't very compact. Ugh. Was this just Nuno completely getting it wrong?
I don't know, Ryan, because we just saw this exact same shape work really well for 45 minutes against Chelsea. And then they give up an early goal last weekend in the second half shifts, and there's some other things that happen there as well. And they lose 3-0. And they come out here and give up three goals very quickly as well. So the pressing was not good enough in this game. You mentioned that second goal already, Ryan. It's the Aubameyang goal in the 27th minute that puts Arsenal up 2-0. Arsenal just carve right through Tottenham's pressure. And that happened a few other times where Tottenham pressed in their 4-3-3 shape, which, again, thought worked really well against Chelsea, and they shut down a lot of angles. We didn't see it working out that way in this one. Then with the ball, Tottenham, I thought, were sloppy. I didn't think they had the consistent ability on the ball to move it through midfield, advance the ball to the final third, and create chances. And they didn't really create chances in the first half. The second half, it evened out a little bit. But they struggled in a lot of phases of play in this game. And they had some nice moments in the second 45. The goal from Son is a nice piece of play. I think it comes down, at least in large part, to a mistake from Arsenal's right side in them not being able to organize that pressure. But it is a nice goal when Brian Hill comes on and it's Heung-min Son getting that goal in the 79th minute. But so inconsistent from Tottenham, they couldn't consistently win the ball in midfield that then would allow them to get those extra sequences of possession. They struggled to contain Arsenal's possession play themselves. They struggled to create attacking chances. This was a tough one from Nuno's squad, and they did not play well in the slightest.
They certainly didn't. Graham, what happened here with Tottenham? They started the season so well. They looked so good against Manchester City at the start of the season. Top of the table in August. Nuno, manager of the month for the first month. How do you get from there to what we saw here? And is it just that we're not in a transfer window anymore and Harry Kane has sort of cooled off the jets a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way this season has panned out for Tottenham is maybe a lesson for all of us not to look too early at the Premier League table. I mean, literally a month ago, Tottenham were at the top of the table and Arsenal were at the bottom of the table, 20th place, which had never happened before. And now it seems like Arsenal are heading in the right direction and Spurs are heading in the wrong direction. I came across a rather concerning statistic for Tottenham with regards to Nuno Espirito Santo. So in the last 365 days, his teams, Nuno's teams, so Wolves and this Tottenham team, have played 42 Premier League games and scored just 37 goals, which is not what you want especially for a club like Spurs, who in recent years under Pochettino very much prided themselves on their kind of dynamic attacking play. They have probably the best striker in Europe, out and out striker anyway, in European football. And I think this was a game that really thrust into focus the situation Spurs are in with Nuno. They wanted a manager to wash away the lingering conservatism of the Mourinho reign. But now they have a manager who very much sees the game in a similar way. At least with Mourinho, he had a winning track record. You know, he'd won the Premier League, he'd won titles in lots of countries, so you could maybe justify the compromise. In Nuno, and I'm very wary of straying into hot take territory, but in Nuno, Spurs now have a manager who was their fourth or fifth choice, who's never finished higher than seventh in the Premier League. Not only this, but Nuno was on a downward trajectory at Wolves, his last club. And Wolves fans weren't exactly distraught to see him leave. So I'm just not entirely sure whether he's the man to take Tottenham where they want to go. I don't know whether he's the man to put in the principles of they've got a new director of football in Paratici Spurs, who I assume will want to put in principles that kind of outlast managers, that kind of go beyond single managerial appointments. And I'm just not sure whether those principles can be put in place with Nuno as their manager. And I just think it's not looking good for Nuno, both in terms of their performances on the pitch and also just a lot of the body language. It's more than just Kane. You know, Kane is obviously not playing well at the moment. He doesn't look that interested. He's not being helped by how isolated he is in this system. But after this game, you had Hugo Lloris, who's the club captain, come out and he's very scathing of the way that Spurs played. But Lucas Moura actually dissected the game plan in a public setting. He said that they gave Arsenal too much space. Spurs didn't try to have the ball. He essentially disagreed that Spurs weren't trying to build moves through passing, through midfield. A direct quote from him was, "So many long balls." That doesn't sound like a player who agrees with the current coaching of this team.
No, that doesn't sound like a manager who's necessarily in charge of the dressing room, Graham. Let me put it this way to you, Graham. Next two Premier League games are Aston Villa and at Newcastle. If they don't get any points from those two, how much trouble is Nuno in at this very early stage?
Yeah, I think he would be in trouble. Spurs and Daniel Levy have shown that they are willing to make a pretty hasty change. You know, obviously Pochettino was sacked. I think people would have given him longer before he was sacked. So Levy's shown that he's willing to do that. Mourinho was sacked, what, 5 days before a cup final? I have to say those two decisions haven't worked out for Levy. But what I'm saying is he doesn't tend to wait very long. He does pull the trigger quite quickly. And so, as you say, if those results don't go well and if they don't play well as well, I think the way they're playing is almost as concerning. You know, teams can go through bad patches in terms of results, but Spurs are offering next to nothing as an attacking outfit and they don't look too solid at the back either. I mean, why is Christian Romero on the bench? Why is Emerson Royale, both two players who were big summer signings, who were brought in to kind of change that defence, why are they not starting games like this? And you have Damson Sanchez and Eric Dier, both of whom were deemed not good enough last season and they've shown nothing this season. Okay, that's a bit harsh on Dier. He had a couple good games, but not enough this season to suggest that they should be in the team ahead of someone like Christian Romero, who was the best defender in Serie A this season and has cost Spurs a lot of money. I just don't get a lot of the decisions that not just Nuno is making, but Spurs are a club are making, and I'm not sure they'll wait too long to try and correct course, particularly if there's a better option out there.
Joe, let's talk about Harry Kane specifically as well. His giveaway led to the third goal. He tried to track back, but sort of missed the tackle in doing so. He had a chance where he was also kind of one-on-one in just after the hour mark and put it wide as well. On NBC, Joe, they said he's mentally not dialed in. They said he was in a rut. They said he checked out. What's your thoughts on the way he's playing right now? And is it simply that he didn't get his move and he's sort of, you know, his productivity has dropped because of that?
There's no way to know what the answer to that particular question is, Ryan, as to if it's because he didn't get that move to City, unless we've got Harry Kane's brother on the line. And even then, I'm still not sure I believe him. We don't know, right? We don't know what's going on here with Harry Kane from a personal standpoint. We don't know if he's in a rut. We don't know any of that stuff. And I think speculating on that is not especially useful. What we can talk about, though, is how he wasn't impactful in this game. And I guess he was impactful if you're Arsenal, right? The second goal, or the Kane slipping goal and then him sliding in the box that you just described, Ryan, it's kind of funny, to be honest. It was funny to watch. I enjoyed that little sequence. I think I am this podcast's Harry Kane defender, because I think if I'm Tottenham, I'm looking at the structural problems around Harry Kane and my inability to create consistent chances. More so that, or I'm looking at the defensive struggles that give up three goals. I'm looking at those things more than I'm looking at Harry Kane. And yes, Harry Kane was at fault for one of those goals. So there is blame to be portioned off to Harry Kane here. But I think Harry Kane is a brilliant number nine. And I think him and Son and even Lucas Moura form a pretty dangerous attacking trio. Tottenham just had breakdowns in areas that didn't allow them to create those consistent chances. I'm working to fix those things much before I'm really looking to Harry Kane or even moving Harry Kane to the bench. If I'm Nuno, now I recognize that I might be alone in that particular viewpoint, at least among the three of us. But I think Harry Kane brings a lot of value to this team. And though he may be in a rut right now, changing him out of the lineup from at least in a long-term way, I think is an overreaction.
The other thing to mention, some context, is that I think I'm right in saying that Harry Kane has a track record of starting seasons slowly. I haven't done the research on this, so it's off the top of my head a little bit. But was there not a record he doesn't score in August? Last season was,
yeah,
or the season before was the first time he'd scored in August in the Premier League or something like that. So that when you factor that in, it's maybe not that unusual that he's started quite slowly, because that's something he tends to do even when the system is built around him.
Yep, that's fair enough. It's English striker syndrome. Wayne Rooney used to have the same thing, I believe, Graham. So we can maybe give some dispensation for that. But I guess we're learning we have a Harry Kane defender on this pod. We have a Timo Werner defender in Graham Ruthven. And after this break, we have a game with very little defending, because we're going to talk about Brentford-Liverpool just after this.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned. We're going Premier League heavy this weekend review, and we're going to take ourselves to West London, to Brentford, who drew 3-3 with Liverpool. Graham, this one described as an instant classic with Liverpool in their yellow submarine shirts. Brentford took the lead here in open play as well. We had Curtis Jones scoring a rocket. Lots of very entertaining stuff. Graham, was it as wonderful for you as it was for me?
Oh, yeah, I thought this was game of the weekend, which is why we are talking about it when we've already spoken about two Premier League games. We felt like we couldn't leave this one out. Everything about it was good. You know, Brentford more than contributed. They are a really bold team who do a lot of interesting things. We'll probably speak about that a little bit more here. And then obviously Liverpool have always been a bold team who do interesting things. Everything from the stadium, I love that. I mean, I've not visited in person, but on TV, the Brentford Stadium looks like a fantastic venue for football. The only thing I wasn't so keen on was that Liverpool away shirt, that yellow shirt. It kind of is a cross between something you would expect your server at Five Guys or McDonald's to be wearing. It's not my favourite.
I mean, I like Five Guys, and I kind of like that shirt. Maybe that's why, Graham.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I like Five Guys as well. I'm just not sure it's the best look for a Premier League football team. But okay, I get it. If it's an evocative of burgers and fries, then sure.
Well, if that's not a good look for them, Graham, I'd also suggest that conceding three goals at Brentford is not a good look for them either. Liverpool looking very exciting here. And the opening 15 minutes of this game were brilliant. They were just end-to-end, and the rest of the game was excellent as well. But it was a blistering opening here. And Joe, Liverpool pressing really well and going forward and doing all Liverpool things, but what caused them to concede three goals here? Was it a lack of, I don't know if you can call it a lack of midfield strength, but you know, we have Firmino coming in to play midfield at one point here. What happened for Liverpool?
A lot of it for me comes down to individual defensive errors, right? The first goal that Ethan Pinnock scores off of that set piece, Liverpool just don't clear the box. Right, they don't clear the ball out of the box, excuse me. The ball's rolling across and Ivan Toney gets a little touch to it and Pinnock scores towards the back post, but Liverpool cannot clear the danger. It's poor set-piece defending from Liverpool. And in the third goal as well, it comes in the 82nd minute for Brentford to get the equalizer. And Liverpool just can't clear the ball out of the box after it's been a cross from the right wing that then's cleaned up towards the back post. So there are these individual defensive mistakes that Jurgen Klopp's going to be watching back in the film room and thinking, man, this could have been 3 points and we might not have even had to have sweat a whole lot to get this result. So there's those sorts of issues for Liverpool. There were some issues as well in midfield. I think winning the ball at times, Brentford brought a lot of muscle and really fought for a lot of those 50-50 balls in midfield. So there are problems there and some problems in terms of their ability to progress the ball. And I really liked what Brentford were doing with their pressure. So there were other problems for Liverpool, but far and away for me, the biggest issue was just those small individual defensive moments where you either clear the ball or you don't. And too often in this game, Liverpool just didn't.
Well, it was Virgil van Dijk who was looking a bit less reassured than usual, Joe. I think he gave up a bit of space for even Toney once or twice, yep. Certainly for a header early on, I noticed. And maybe the Matip-Van Dijk partnership was unsettled here, but maybe because of the pressure that Brentford were giving them, the lack of respect that Brentford were giving them in some ways, I mean that they didn't have any fear of Liverpool here. They were very persistent and very high quality going forward.
Yeah, it made for a fantastic game. The best moment in this game, and I hope you guys caught it, it's not on the field, it's between Jurgen Klopp and Thomas Frank on the sidelines. Yes. Did you guys see this? 93rd minute, yeah. And they just exchanged this beautiful memeable moment, gifable moment, giveable moment, whatever you want to call it. It's after Firmino nearly scores a game winner in the 93rd minute to make it 4-3, and he doesn't score. It's saved, I believe. And Klopp just smiles, and Frank is shocked, and it's an incredible moment between two really charismatic, fun coaches. And I think that also does apply to what we saw on the field. We saw Liverpool-esque things from Liverpool, and we saw some really aggressive Brentford, that we can now call Brentford-esque things from Brentford and Thomas Frank. The way that they
pressed out of that 5-3-2, 3-5-2 shape. They closed on the ball. They stepped forward aggressively. They weren't always way up the field trying to press and do that, but they would even press up out of a mid or low block in that 5-5-3-2 shape. So they did so many really wonderful things defensively, closing down the ball, winning it, playing direct out from the back, but also they have the quality, and this is what they did, I think, more so in the championship last season. They have the quality to get on the ball and play through pressure as well, and we saw that in this game. A phenomenal performance from them in a really entertaining game from the sidelines to the on-field action.
Graham, as the Total Soccer Show's Ivan Toney champion here, he had a very good game, did he not? And was it just me, Graham, or were Brentford kind of targeting Trent a little bit on that left, or his right, on Brentford's left channel? A lot of action going down there and maybe getting the better of him occasionally.
Yeah, I think they did target Alexander-Arnold, and as the game went on, I think they actually had a go at Andy Robertson as well. I thought Andy Robertson had one of the kind of poorer games I've seen him have for Liverpool. He actually hasn't had a great start to the season, and I think maybe Kostas Tsimikas might come back into that first team just to take Robertson out for maybe a couple games. I'd maybe predict that. But Ivan Toney, I love Ivan Toney. I think he is... I think I said in the last week's pod that Chris Fryer had maybe gone slightly over the top by saying it was the best, last week's Toney performance was the best performance he'd seen from a centre forward. But with every game I see of Toney in the Premier League, I kind of get where Ayer is coming from in that he does everything. He's a finisher, he's a facilitator, he's a front man who can hold up the ball, he can spin in behind, he's good in the air, he's good on the ground, he helps out defensively. And there was an interesting moment talking, Joe, you were mentioning Frank and Klopp in discussion after the match. There was another interesting moment where Klopp and Ivan Toney were kind of talking to each other, and it just got me thinking, there's all this talk of maybe Liverpool would move for a more orthodox centre forward as an option, and I just think Toney would actually do really well for Liverpool. I think he has the technical ability to fit into that system, but also offer something a little bit differently. Although maybe we shouldn't read too much into these full-time discussions, because I'm still waiting for Guardiola to sign Nathan Redmond.
Gents, I wonder if there's something I kind of observed in this game, in that Brentford kept trying to catch out Liverpool's high line by, on set pieces and then various other points, keeping a man or two miles offside and letting play catch up with them. And then that, in turn, stretched Liverpool at the back. The first and second goals seemed to follow that pattern where I think... Which one was the set piece? Was that the first goal or the second goal? So that one, there was a couple of players miles off, and then they let the play catch up, and it was almost as if, I don't know, the centre-backs are looking over their shoulder a bit and got a bit stretched by that. Whether it was deliberate or not, it happened a few times, Joe.
I'd be unsettled by that as a centre-back, and those players are much more equipped to deal with those situations than I am, certainly. I don't need to say that. But I think there is something to that pattern, Ryan, or at least to the intricacies of Brentford set pieces. They're one of the most analytically minded and analytically guided teams in the world, right? That has to do with their ownership, which you talked about in our Premier League previews, Ryan, if I remember correctly. And it comes down, as far as I can tell, to all these different parts of their organization. And we certainly see that on the field. I talked about set pieces, I think, at some point in one of the shows last week. Maybe it was listener questions. We talked about set pieces and how a lot of teams are trying to take more and better advantage of them, because it can be this marginal gain for a team compared to the opposition. And we saw that in this one from Brentford with some creative set piece designs. And a lot of it stems, again, from individual issues that Liverpool had defending those set pieces. But still, you want to be putting players in positions to have to make those challenging calls as a defensive team. And so I think Brentford did a brilliant job of that. And a lot of that stems from how they choose to approach set pieces in a more creative way relative to a lot of the rest of the world.
Indeed. Brentford ninth in the Premier League after this round of games. Graham, are they going to do okay? They're going to stay up this year?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely going to stay up. I think they've got a pretty good chance of even finishing in the top half. You know, obviously there's precedent for that with Sheffield United 2 seasons ago, Leeds United last season. I think Brentford this season are a really solid team. As Joe mentions, they are driven by data, which gives them kind of an advantage over a lot of their rivals. One of the things that strikes me is how they very rarely make a bad signing. So when they spend money, you see it on the pitch. You know, Vitaly Janelt, who was very impressive again in this game, and perhaps most notably, Hansi Flick was at the Brentford Community Stadium to watch this one. So maybe we might be seeing Janelt in the Germany squad soon. But he cost just £250,000. Christopher Ayer, who cost a bit more than that, but he's already looking a bit of a bargain at £13 million. He's slotted straight into this team. So, yeah, I like what I see from Brentford. Obviously, that second season syndrome tends to be quite troublesome, as Leeds are actually discovering this season. But I just think Brentford do so many things well. And as I say, they sign really well that maybe second season syndrome won't hit them. But maybe that's looking a little bit too far ahead.
Yeah, definitely nice to be a Brentford fan right now. Not so much a Norwich fan. You're probably wishing you were back to in the Championship, you know, winning games and having a bit more fun.
Yeah, someone save Billy Gilmore, please. It's in our national interest.
All right, that was a very, very entertaining game. Let's turn our attention to the continent, gentlemen. Serie A, Milan had a 2-1 win over Spezia. That put them top on Saturday. A goal from Daniel Maldini in his first start, Graham, in the third Maldini generation to play for the club. I can't wait for his son and his son and his son to play for Milan one day.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you go to Eton in the UK, you're going to be British Prime Minister. If you're a Maldini, you're going to play for AC Milan.
Indeed. Elsewhere, Juventus got a 3-2 win over Sampdoria. Paolo Dybala scored a great goal, but unfortunately left the field in tears with an injury. He's going to miss that aforementioned Champions League clash with Chelsea. But the Italian game we shall focus our attentions on, Lazio 3, Roma 2. A goal-packed Derby della Capitale here, Joe. This one, Sarri versus Mourinho, probably the highest caliber of managers we've seen in this derby for a while. Jose Mourinho's second loss in a row and his second loss after a 100% start with Roma as well. Joe, it seemed that Lazio very much played the Man City over Chelsea role here. They very much outplayed Roma in this one.
Yep, I completely agree, Ryan. I don't think you could find... Well, you probably could. I don't think you could find many managers that think about football as differently as Jose Mourinho and Maurizio Sarri do, right? Two very different ways of playing the game, two very different ways of going out and trying to win soccer games. And I think we saw that play out in this Rome derby. You've got Roma in this 4-4-2, very Jose Mourinho-esque. They have some creativity with their front four, but they're not really trying to break you down with the ball, and that would have been a surprising move from Jose Mourinho. Contrasting that with Lazio, with Maurizio Sarri, who played a very Maurizio Sarri-esque game. 4-3-3 shape, lots of rotations off the ball, tons of these little intricate bits of combination play where there's three players close to the ball and they're just playing a little pre-match rondo in the game. And they play the ball around a Roma defender, they play the ball around a pressing Roma attacker, and they break through and they keep building. Or maybe it's a diamond where four players have suddenly formed this quadrilateral and they're passing the ball around quickly and moving it and advancing play. It's beautiful to watch from Lazio, and they were dominant in large stretches of this game. Not for the entire game, but certainly for the first 20 minutes, they were dominant, and that allowed them to get on the board. So they come out and they score a quick goal in the 10th minute. It's from Milinkovic-Savic, a beautiful bit of possession play and a great run into the box from Milinkovic-Savic, who scores that headed finish in the 10th minute. And then 9 minutes later, it's Pedro on the counter. So after 20 minutes in this game, it's 2-0. And Jose Mourinho's team at that point is in a really tough spot because they don't have a lot of ability to break someone down in possession. And Lazio at that point didn't have a lot of motivation to go and stretch the game. So it did end up getting a bit stretched and it got a bit chaotic. But at the end of the day, a strong performance from Lazio in this 3-2 win, I thought.
Joe, can I ask you a question about the style of Lazio? Do you think Mourinho and Roma were slightly surprised at how willing Lazio were to kind of hit out on the counter? Because maybe I have an inaccurate grasp of what Sarri ball is. Obviously, it's defined mostly by kind of intricate possession play in the centre of the pitch. But two of the goals that they score are almost kind of Mourinho-esque goals where they hit out, as I say, quickly on the counter. So do you think that was something that caught Roma by surprise?
Maybe. I think, Graham, if we had Maurizio Sarri on the pod and Ryan could act as our Italian translator. Are you at that level yet, Ryan? I'm just going to pretend you are. And Ryan could translate...
Non parlo italiano, mi dispiace, Joe.
Perfect. All right, that sounds good to me. If we had Sarri on the pod, Graham, I think the way he would describe his style was probably a little differently than how I described it in the opening, in my opening thoughts on this game. I think he would talk about how the goal of his style is to exploit space in behind. If you think about the height of Sarri's Napoli team, when they were doing those incredible bits of build-up, right? they would come after drawing the opposition forward. They would almost force the other team to come and step into Napoli's defensive third, the opposing team's attacking third. And then they would combine, beat them with those triangles or those diamonds on the ball, those rondos, and play in behind. And the key there is playing in behind. That's where the space is. That, in my mind, is always the space that Sarri's wanted to target. Because if you get in behind, you're running in on goal with little to no resistance. So in this game for Lazio, the opportunities presented themselves to do that when they had possession and they could draw Roma forward and combine and beat them in possession. But those opportunities come the easiest, and those moments are the simplest when the other team's already forward. They've done your job for you at that point. So maybe Jose Mourinho and Roma were a little bit surprised by the fact that Lazio could hit them so aggressively on the counter. But I think that's always been sort of an underrated part of Maurizio Sarri's teams, and really any high-level possession team, is the ability to exploit space in behind on the break. And Lazio did that very well.
Graham, something that struck me in this game, in Lazio's game specifically, was Ciro Immobile and the role he played here. He missed a few opportunities in front of goal, hit the side netting a few times and got the crowd very excited by that. But, you know, gets two assists, set up Anderson for the third goal, was involved in all three, actually. Is Ciro Immobile like a upgraded version of Timo Werner? Is he what Chelsea fans thought Timo Werner was going to be? In that, you know, doesn't always hit the net straight away. Maybe I'm not making the right point here, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, he's almost like an upgraded Werner in his contributions to goal, and maybe, you know, the way he finds space and not always getting it in the back of the net.
Yeah, I think he, Immobile, is what Chelsea want Werner to be now. I think, to be honest, when they signed Werner, they thought Werner was just going to be a 20-plus goal-a-season striker. I think there was a misunderstanding, and I probably was quite guilty of that myself. There was a misunderstanding of the kind of player he was. So I would say now, yeah, Werner should look at Immobile and look at his contribution. As you say, he doesn't score in this game. He misses a couple of opportunities, but still notches two assists and is still crucial to the way that Lazio play out on the counter-attack, particularly for the second goal, where he kind of conducts that whole counter-attack on his own, draws two or three Roma defenders over to him, which then creates the space for Pedro to then finish from the edge of the box. The finish from Pedro, was that not very reminiscent of his goal in the 2011 Champions League final? How he kind of just guides it into the bottom right-hand corner after all the defenders have kind of been drawn away from him, the pass comes his way. I think it was maybe Villa that passed the, or Iniesta that passed the ball out to him. Anyway, I thought that front two of Pedro and Immobile were very effective, and even Felipe Anderson as well, his cross, the goal that Joe was mentioning, was just, I loved that ball because the camera was right behind it. You could see what was unfolding with Milinkovic-Savic getting there before Patricio. And I'm really pleased to see Felipe Anderson doing well for Lazio again after a pretty underwhelming time at West Ham. There's a really good player in there, and he was excellent in his first spell at Lazio. So I am pleased to see him do well again. And Ryan, I've got a question for you, given that you are our local correspondent for this game now. What was I'm always very interested in derbies. It's my like kind of bucket list thing is to tick off derbies around the world. I haven't done the Rome derby yet. So given you're in the city, what was kind of the feeling in the city on the day of the game? Is it quite tense, or does Rome just have so much going on that you wouldn't really be able to tell if you didn't know it was happening?
Disappointingly, Graham, I'd say it was more towards the latter category. I wasn't able to get a ticket for this game, but I went into central Rome to sort of check out and see what the vibe was there. I think on the train and in central Rome, I went to, like, you know, the very center, like Spanish Steps and around that court sort of area into the Borghese and the park. And I maybe saw two Roma shirts and one Lazio shirt the whole time I was there in the few hours before kickoff. And I think it's because it's a relatively big city, Graham. And if you went to Buckingham Palace on the day of a Chelsea game, you might not see a load of Chelsea shirts. It's probably more like that. I wasn't near the stadium. But certainly it's something that's been talked about all week. It's something that's very exciting for people around here because there's only two teams that people would support in these parts. But yeah, I was hoping to get like a train pack full of fans and to have a bit of, you know, atmosphere in the centre of the city. But unfortunately, I didn't see that. But as I say, I wasn't near the Stadio Olimpico or the Foro Italico or anywhere near that area. So next time when I get a ticket for one of these things, I shall...
Yeah, you'll need to get a ticket to go to one. I've never been to the Stadio Olimpico, but around it looks so kind of picturesque, and with the hill above it, with the trees and a lot of kind of statues around it. I don't know if you've been, but it looks fantastic.
Well, it's a really, really stunning area. Well, the city's stunning as well. But if the just outside the Stadio Olimpico, you've got the Foro Italico where they do the Italian Open as well. And it's a clay, so it looks really beautiful. And it's got all those statues that on that part of it, and also the statues that surround it. Statues everywhere in Rome, by the way. Like busts and just random headless statues absolutely everywhere. They love them here. Most of them fascist, Graham, but that's a conversation for another day. Or not most of them, quite a lot of them, I should say. I've gone off track. What was I going to talk about? Rome, that's right. Roma specifically, Joe. My two observations from Roma's side of things is that Veretout, his corners are hit like shots. They go at like 200 miles an hour. I was enjoying that very much. And Zaniolo for the penalty win. That penalty win, Joe, presumably went through review. He sort of swung at the ball and missed it with zero contact, was my takeaway.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. Well, I might be, but at least not about this particular thing. I was baffled by that penalty decision. I don't know exactly what went on there behind the scenes. It looked very strange to me, and like there was little to no contact as well. But I do want to say, I generally agree with your thoughts on Roma, that Ryan. My overarching thought about them in this game was I really liked the dynamics of the front four. With Tammy Abraham as the nine, this is in a 4-2-3-1 kind of shape. So you've got a 9, a 10, and two narrow wingers for the most part. You've got Tammy Abraham as the 9. You've got Mkhitaryan as the 10 underneath him floating. You've got El Shaarawy on the left. And then you've got Zaniolo on the right. I thought they worked together very well. And they provided the danger that Roma needed because there's not this stable platform behind them. Abraham is dynamic with his movements off the ball, and he's also able to get on the ball and drive down into the half spaces or into those outer corridors at the box. Mkhitaryan, we know how good he can be at times. Same with the two wingers as well. I thought they were bright, a little inconsistent at times, especially with Zaniolo on that right side, but he was getting into the box and drawing phantom penalties, and you've got to give him credit for that. There was a lot to like about this Roma front four, and I think this is maybe an obvious thing to say, if they are a little cleaner defensively earlier on in this game and take care of the ball just a bit better and don't leave themselves so exposed, this could have gone a different way because Roma does have the attacking talent to play with any team in Serie A.
Yeah, Joe, I totally agree. And before this match, there was a lot of talk about Lorenzo Pellegrini, who was missing through suspension. And I think a lot of people expected him to be a big miss. He's got 3 goals and 1 assist in 5 Serie A games this season. But I don't think Roma lost this game on the attacking side. You know, it was the defensive side that lost the game for them, and El Shaarawy did a pretty good job of deputising on that left side. Or rather, Pellegrini would have been the number 10, Mkhitaryan on the left side. But yeah, there wasn't much of a drop-off there, really.
One of my observations is about the defence as well. Karsdrop, not quite Alessandro Florenzi. Why is he at Milan and not here? I don't quite understand why. Any idea, Graham?
I would suggest it's a Mourinho thing, but he was on loan last season at PSG as well. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe just someone in the Roma executive doesn't like Florenzi. I don't know. He's definitely a better option at right back than Karsdorp.
Yeah, he's a very good player. I don't understand that. But a very entertaining Derby della Capitale we had here with 5 goals. But why don't we have a quick look at some other leagues? Let's go to the Bundesliga. Borussia Mönchengladbach 1, Borussia Dortmund 0. The Marco Rosa Derby, if you will. Some Rosa revenge here for Gladbach. No Haaland for Dortmund, maybe making the difference in this one. He took a knock in training before this game. And no Marco Reus either, which may have been more of a difference maker, him being a massive creative outlet, certainly for Dortmund at the moment. And Dortmund went down to 10 men, De Hu getting 2 relatively silly yellows in this one. But the big news, Joe, RB Leipzig getting a big W, 6-0 over Hertha Berlin. That's got to be good news for Jesse Marsch getting things back on track there.
It's a big result for Leipzig, right? We've been talking about how the pressure is building, and maybe he's not immediately at risk of being fired, but the results needed to start coming, and a 6-goal outing is a great way to get those results coming. It's a massive result for Leipzig. They're not, you know, near the top of the table right now. They're in 10th in the Bundesliga. But that's the kind of result that you need after the poor start to the season. You're building maybe a little bit of confidence heading into a midweek Champions League game. This is exactly what Leipzig needed, and the fact that they get that result, I think, is huge for Jesse Marsch.
Indeed it is. And we've discovered that Wolfsburg are the Spurs of the Bundesliga, starting so strongly. They've lost twice in a row now. They lost to Hoffenheim 3-1 this week. And another 3-1 as well, just like Spurs this weekend as well. Graham, did you watch any La Liga action this weekend? And if so, pray tell us.
Yes, I did indeed, and it was another interesting weekend in La Liga. It started off the early game on the Saturday, Alaves versus Atletico Madrid. Alaves take an early lead, but at that point, Atleti probably aren't panicking too much because we've seen them mount a number of comebacks already this season from similar sort of situations, except on this occasion, the comeback never came, and Alaves pick up their first points of the season. A shock result there, Atleti losing ground in the title race. Saturday night was maybe the marquee match of the whole weekend. You had Real Madrid against Villarreal. Villarreal haven't started the season that well, but they have a lot of quality, obviously. Unai Emery, a good coach as well. That one ends 0-0, and Villarreal might have come away from the Bernabeu thinking they might have actually got all 3 points, and particularly the first half, they were the dominant side. I think this was a bit of a reality check for Real Madrid, who have been very good so far this season, particularly in the attacking third, the likes of Benzema, Asensio, Vinicius, even Hazard contributing so far this season. But they were held at arm's length by a very well organised, very well coached Villarreal team. And then on Sunday, you had Barcelona against Levante, a must-win match for Ronald Koeman's future. Of course, he is under intense pressure. They'd gone 3 games without a win. They had lost to Bayern Munich in the Champions League, then back-to-back draws against Granada and Cadiz in La Liga. But this was much more routine for them. Memphis getting the first goal, Luke de Jong getting the second goal. And then the headline from this match is Ansu Fati making his long-awaited return from injury. This kid just isn't normal. The hype and the expectation around him has grown and grown and grown and grown as he's been out injured, as Messi has left, as he's been handed the number 10 shirt as Messi's successor. He comes off the bench with 15 minutes to go and he scores this incredibly well-taken goal from the edge of the box. He celebrates in the stand with the club doctor that's helped him through the last 10 months or so, which was a nice moment. And all of a sudden, I know it's just one match, but all of a sudden the picture is looking a little bit better for Barcelona, particularly if they can get Ansu fit and in form again. He kind of transforms that team a little bit.
Wow, good to see Ansu Fati living up to the 10 shirt as well. There was a risk that could have backfired pretty badly, Graham, so I'm glad to see he's doing okay wearing those digis. MLS action. The Red Bulls won the New York Derby 1-0 on that baseball field in the Bronx. We had wins for both the conference leaders as well.
Yeah, I've got 3 quick bullet points from MLS this weekend, and the Derby will be touched on a little bit later. First, I've got Seattle beating Sporting Kansas City. That's the biggest game of the weekend. The 2 best teams in the Western Conference. Seattle beat SKC 2-1 in Kansas City. Some really chaotic energy in this game, particularly for Seattle's second goal, but a great result for the Sounders that puts them on top of the Western Conference after a midweek loss to Lyon in the League's Cup Finals. So much credit for what Seattle have built, right? Brian Schmetzer, Garth Lagerwey, they're insane. They're good all the time at this point, and they don't get enough credit, even though I think a lot of folks heap credit on them continuously. They are just a phenomenal team. But maybe the bigger note than this particular win is that after the game, Brian Schmetzer, head coach, said that Jordan Morris, who's been out all season rehabbing from an ACL tear that he suffered while on loan with Swansea, Jordan Morris apparently is going to be back in training by the end of the week, which is phenomenal news for the Sounders because they're going to be out without Nico Ladero, their number 10, for at least a stretch of time as he's recovering from a knee surgery himself. So that is phenomenal news for Seattle. The rich get richer, I guess, to use that cliche. Bullet point number 2, the West was a little bit wild this week. San Jose beat LAFC 2-0. Austin beat the Galaxy last night, Sunday night, 2-0. Minnesota beat Houston 2-0. Vancouver beat FC Dallas 1-0. But the craziest result in the West, Portland beating RSL 6-1. Yeah, 6-1, another 6-goal result for someone across global soccer. RSL's head coaching situation is looking a bit more pressing after they lost Freddy Juarez, who is now an assistant on Brian Schmetzer's staff in Seattle. Bullet point number 3. Chaos in the Eastern Conference. The Eastern Conference, guys, is insane. Ryan, you mentioned that New York Derby result. The Red Bulls had been poor and maybe still are bad in the Eastern Conference, but they managed to get a win over NYCFC, which is a great result for them. Just 3 points separate third from eighth in the Eastern Conference right now. 3 points, guys. That is nothing. The Eastern Conference is in absolute mayhem right now. 9 points separate third from 11th. So it's a bit of a wider margin. But you can go down all the way to the 11th team in the Eastern Conference and still say that they have a reasonable chance to sneak into the playoffs. That 11th place team right now is the New York Red Bulls. NYCFC in third with 39 points. Really, the only two teams that are safe in the East is New England and Nashville. New York City will be safe. There's a couple other teams that are going to be fine as well. But things are wild in the Eastern Conference right now. Things are wild in MLS right now. The stretch run and headed into the playoffs, that whole slew of games is going to be insane.
Yeah, just looking at both conferences, Joe, it looks like there's so many teams that are still on for playoff contention. And in the West as well, you've got three teams below the playoffs within 3 points of it as well. There's plenty to play for.
Yeah, there is plenty to play for. And I think this is exactly what MLS wants, right, is some degree of parity and competitive parity that they can manufacture. And they're getting that. And there are only a few teams, at least in my view, that have a realistic shot of winning silverware this season. The Revs have the supporter shield wrapped up at this point. They haven't clinched it, but they are going to win that trophy. And they are one of the few teams that I think has the quality to actually make a run through MLS Cup playoffs. That said, playoffs are designed to be wonky. So is it impossible that San Jose could sneak into the playoff field and then go on to win this whole thing? Yeah. Is it likely? No, but stranger things have happened. It's going to be wild, like I say.
It's nice, Joe, in my opinion, that so many teams are in contention this season, because obviously next year when Charlotte FC dominate, it's out of the question that anyone else can win, then it's nice that they've got this season at least, don't you think?
Yeah, it's kind of Charlotte to give everybody a year before they just come in and ruin the whole parity structure. Yeah.
Yep. That was the intention. All right. On that note, Joe, thank you very much for your contributions on this weekend review. A pleasure as always, sir.
You got it, Ryan. Thanks for conducting our orchestra.
Oh, I do try. Graham Rutten, thank you so much for the soccer chat, the F1 chat, and just about all the chat we had today.
Thank you, Ryan. It's always fun.
Listener, thank you very much. We'll be back very shortly, but for now, bye!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.